Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and at the controls, Henry Frain. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about dirt. And here, really, we're not talking about the kinds of thing that you go after with your vacuum cleaner in your house. We're talking about soil, the kind of things that what's in the home landscape and what we eat and what we see around us, all those growing things, it's all rooted in soil. And as you're walking around in your yard, probably, or maybe if you're out in the woods or you're walking in a farm field, maybe you think about the soil under your feet as something that is solid and unchanging, but that is not so. It is something that was created, and it's something that can be lost, and if you lose it at a rate faster than it's created, you have a problem. You need to have a balance between those two things. So this morning we'll be talking with David Montgomery. He's professor of Earth and Space Sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle. And we'll be talking about a book that he has authored. The title is Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations. It's published by the University of California Press, in which he makes the argument that there is solid evidence that soil erosion influenced the longevity of many past civilizations. And he further argues that it was basically agriculture, plow-based agriculture, that was the engine that drove this soil erosion. Those are the ideas in the book. We'll lay them out for you here this morning. And also, of course, people who are listening are welcome to call in with questions and comments. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief, so we can keep moving and get in as many as possible. And we hope people will be focused on the topic. But otherwise, questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, your questions are certainly welcome. Professor Montgomery, hello.
Good morning. How are you, David?
I'm fine. Thanks. And you?
Oh, just fine, thanks. The rain has returned to Seattle, so things are good out here again.
I thought it always rained in Seattle.
Oh, we had a brief scare with sunshine a couple weeks ago.
Oh, I'm sure that concerned a lot of people there. People are probably feeling much better. Well, right. I'm really pleased that you could be with us, and I know that I saw a little bit of a talk that you gave where you said that really you wanted to call this the book something like, you know, Soil, the Essence of Civilization, but the publisher said no one's going to buy that book. So,
well, you know, they didn't have to argue too hard to convince me of that. It was they liked the title that it went with, but it also had the benefit of being a little sacrilegious for soil scientists, which is it never hurts to sort of shake things up a bit.
All right, maybe we could start by having you talk a little bit about how actually soil is created. Where does it come from?
Well, you know, soil is one of those things that there's lots of different definitions, and that's why people argue about whether you should ever call soil dirt. And it's really a mix of two things. It's a mix of sort of the broken down weathering products of rocks and biological things, both living organisms and dead things. You know, and soil per se is the dead parts or organic matter plus mineral soil. But there's a surprising amount of life in the soil that helps sort of sustain things like soil fertility. So it's hard to sort of think about soils without thinking about the life that's in them as well.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, and I'm sure that's something that horticulturalists really know and the people who grow things understand, that the soil is alive and it needs to be alive, and it can look good, but if it's sterile, if it's dead, then it's not going to be. Maybe by doing various things, you can get stuff to grow in it, but it's not what it should be.
Yeah, you can have, if you have soil that is essentially sterile without life, the fertility in it is going to be just what you add to it. It'll be sort of like the medium for adding chemicals to. But in terms of native soil fertility, a lot of the ability for plants to draw nutrition from the soil depends on mycorrhizae and organisms breaking down that material and sort of cycling. So you could think of a healthy, fertile soil in a natural system that draws its sustenance in great part just from the continual turnover and cycling of life.
Mm. And what sort of role do living things actually play in the creation of soil, in the making of it?
Well, you know, soils are pretty diverse in the sense, in really the truest sense of the word. There's lots of different kinds of them in different environments around the planet, and biology, the kinds of plants that live on the land and the kind of organisms that inhabit the soil and do things to the land, like people, are some of the biggest influences on both soil production and also soil erosion. And if you think about in a forested environment like out here on the Pacific Northwest, where you know we've had there's an awful lot of trees out here, and many of them in a native forest will fall over rather than snap when they die, and the roots will pry up rock and mix that up into the soil. Eventually, it'll break down. And there's places where that process of, called tree throw, if roots ripping rocks up when trees fall over, is one of the dominant forces in soil formation. But in some parts of the tropics, termites are one of the big mechanisms that chew rocks up and mix it in with the soil. Gophers in grasslands, there's a real rich variety of ways that life influences the development of soils that in turn end up sustaining life.
How long does this process take? How long does it take to make new soil?
Well, you know, it's pretty slow. we're talking fractions of a millimeter a year in most systems. And again, it varies greatly depending on where you are on the planet. If you're in a place that's really hot with lots of rainfall, rocks will break down faster. And if you're in a place that's fairly cold with cold and dry, say an Arctic desert, rocks are going to break down fairly slowly. But in terms of a gross rate at which soils are produced on average around the planet, you're talking at hundredths to a tenth of a millimeter a year at the high end.
So that would tell you that erosion, even a process of erosion that you might not think was all that serious, because the rate of creation of new soil is so slow, almost sounds like almost any erosion is going to run out faster than you're going to be able to make new soil.
Yeah, if you think about soil as essentially a natural bank account, where you've got the income is how rocks break down to combine with biologic material to make new soil, and your expenses are erosion that removes it, and your savings is the amount of soil that you've got on a field or on a hillside or whatever the system you're talking about is. It works just like your bank account. If you spend faster than you make, you're depleting your savings, and soils are no different. So if they do erode faster than they're being remade or produced, then they're not being sustained, they're being lost. And the question is really how long will it take to either run out of soil completely or to run out, to deplete it enough that something changes, different kinds of vegetation will grow, or that it comes to a different steady state soil thickness. Say.
Yeah. Just let me sort of jump to the central argument here for a second, so we can give it to people. And you know, we're already getting some calls, so we get some folks into the conversation. But it essentially here, what I understand you're saying is that for some time now, people have argued that soil erosion caused largely by deforestation led to the decline of a number of civilizations around the world. However, what you're saying is you're not saying that deforestation is not a problem, but that's not enough to explain the degree of soil loss that we have seen. So your argument is that agriculture, plow-based agriculture, was a much bigger factor in the soil erosion than deforestation, or it sounds like anything else.
Well, yeah, that's essentially the argument I came to. That wasn't when I started writing the book. That wasn't what I thought. I was writing sort of a history of soil erosion, and I had read the arguments for deforestation as the cause of ancient soil erosion in society after society in environmental history textbooks, and I was prepared to believe it. But I've done a lot of work on forestry-related issues in coastal Oregon as a geomorphologist, the kind of geologist I am that studies erosion. And the numbers just don't add up. You need to actually keep the trees off for a long time in order to have the sort of a millimeter a year kind of erosion rate eventually add up to enough to strip soils off of hillsides. And it just didn't... The forestry issue seemed to be too simple an answer. It wasn't the whole story. And the more I looked into it, the more solid the evidence was that plow-based agriculture allows erosion to proceed faster than soil production, and that over centuries, literally, it contributed to the decline of classical Greek civilization, Roman civilization, you know, and all the societies that I talk about and synthesize other people's fine work in the book. Mm-hmm. But the story was so clear. When you look at modern erosion rates and you just sort of compile the studies that have been done around the planet in recent decades, looking at rates of erosion under plow-based agriculture and comparing it to what you would have under native vegetation or so-called alternative agricultural practices, no-till agriculture or terraced agriculture, agriculture that's, you know, focused on soil conservation, the differences are, you know, factors of 10 to 100-fold in terms of the net erosion rates. The numbers are still small, so instead of having an erosion rate that would be comparable to the soil production rate of, say, tenths to a hundredths of a millimeter a year, the average rates from what I compiled in the big, you know, in the data that I put together that's behind the book suggest an average erosion rate off agricultural fields globally on the order of a millimeter a year. I could support a higher number than that, but I'm trying to be conservative in the argument. Even with a millimeter a year, if they're being reproduced or remade at you know, a tenth to a hundredth of that, then you've got a few centuries to a thousand years before you could physically completely remove the soil with plow-based agriculture. And as you look backwards through societies, there's, with, you know, the fuzzy glasses that geologists use to do these things, there's a pretty remarkable coincidence in that time scale in terms of the longevity of societies.
Yeah, you make this this interesting observation that you look at these societies' rise and fall, that roughly speaking, we're looking at about 1,000 years, and that what you're saying is that that's also about the time that it would take for people to start to do intensive plow-based agriculture. That results in, makes possible population growth. You get more people, you need more food. That keeps going to the point where the eventually, as a result of this intensive agriculture and the erosion that results, you get a crash. And then, in fact, if you look at the ancient, say, the ancient Middle East, you can see over a period of, like, from the ancient times to the present, about three times that we've gone into that boom and bust cycle, and that's what it is. It's about a 1,000-year cycle.
Yeah, more or less. Some geologists tend to, you know, view sort of long periods of time and round things off because you know, there wasn't actually anybody collecting data at that time in terms of erosion rates. But if you look at the gross longevity of societies in many places, that is, you know, more or less about right. And there's no reason why you would expect societies to last, you know, on the order of the same kind of time frame if you were thinking that climate shifts or politics and wars and sort of, you know, people not sharing toys and being bad to their neighbors were the kind of things that were responsible for in the end setting the longevity of societies. Mm-hmm. Now, to be clear on that, I'm not arguing that, you know, so the erosion of the last grain of sand off the fields of Rome is what caused, you know, the Visigoths to sack the place. but if you look at the sort of the resilience of societies as a function of, you know, how healthy their land is and how much they have relative to their population to feed it and how much they're able to produce from it, that sort of cycle of rising and falling is I think, tied into the state and health of the land.
Our guest is David Montgomery. He's professor of Earth and Space Sciences at University of Washington, Seattle. He's the author of the book King of Fish, The Thousand-Year Run of Salmon, and his most recent is entitled Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations, published by University of California Press. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. If you'd like to join the conversation, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with someone in Kankakee, line 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. A couple of questions. You mentioned the biomass of dirt. Am I correct in my understanding that earthworms are an invasive species that has been introduced into the duff of forested areas and are changing the makeup of the dirt in those areas, in those wooded areas?
I believe that is true, especially in the areas in North America that had been glaciated. I'm not that much of an expert on the biogeography of worms, but the basic point that you're making, I think, is very much right on, that In many parts of North America, earthworms are introduced, and the kinds of worms that are sort of the dominant ones today have been introduced. There used to be really big native worms out in the eastern part of the state of Washington that got absolutely immense in the loess soils of the Palouse. And I don't know that much about the geography of worms in the Midwest and the eastern parts of the U.S., but that there has been a big change in the soil biota and introduction of a lot of worms.
Another question, do you have any, or did you look at the fall of the Mayan cultures in Central America? I've been down there a number of times, and it's amazing how they dug through a lot of dirt and trees and forests to get to the ruins that were once, right on top of the land. Did they run out of air, of usable soils?
Yeah, there's the Mayans are one of the case studies that I used in the book. There's been a lot of really good work by archaeologists and geologists looking at trying to reconstruct the sequence of Mayan agriculture and its rise and the erosion it caused as they spread up onto the steep slopes in the tropics, and how they tried to compensate in places by making terraces and also by trying to farm some of the swamplands and the valley bottoms by building them up and draining part of them. But yeah, there's a strong erosion connection to the rise and fall of Mayan society. Of course, with the Mayans, people also argue about the role of droughts and climate shifts, and the ability of the land to produce food to support populations is going to be both a function of the amount of the health and state of the soil, but also if you get a big drought, okay, it's not going to help. But there's a pretty clear connection to erosion in the Mayan case. The other thing I should state, if you're really interested in the story about sort of the geologic and geographic effectiveness of worms, Charles Darwin's last book that he wrote was a book about worms, and it's a fascinating book. I read it on a flight to Europe once to try and put myself to sleep, and instead it kept me up all night reading it. It's a fascinating book.
Okay, is it Darwin's last book? Okay.
Yeah, it's called, I think, On the Formation of Vegetable Mold, which was the Victorian word for soil. And there was like a paperback 1960s reprint that ought to be pretty findable.
Very good. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. And in fact, that's where you start your book.
Well, or you could read my book. it is what I started with, just because it's such a fascinating story to no matter what one thinks about Darwin and his ideas, his observations on earthworms are really quite fascinating. He took the sort of an experimental approach, grew worms in his living room and to figure out what they ate, manipulated his fields, sent his kids off all over England looking for buried Roman ruins to sort of figure out how far worms had been burying old Roman buildings beneath fresh soil. And he basically pioneered the argument that worms quite literally are nature's tillers. They till the soil, they mix the earth. They're one of the prime processes that helps create fertile soils.
Another caller here, St. Charles next, line one. Hello.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, I have a degree in forestry, actually. I started out there in the Northwest. I was with the Forest Service for a long time, and so I know what you're talking about the sticks. Forest. I live in the Midwest now. Unfortunately, I was driven out because of the environmental aspects of deforestation. Don't cut, so basically it was for growing trees, the genealogy of it. But what I wanted to bring up, and I've noticed this a lot, both in the Northwest and the West and out here, is that they build these subdivisions. They take all this ground usually gets the water to percolate down into our water table, build concrete slabs on there, basically, where you've got acres upon acres, hundreds of thousands of acres worth of concrete. Well, this water has to go somewhere.
Yeah.
Now we're collecting rainwater, but unfortunately it's polluted because by the time it gets into a place, a retention pond or a basin, It's. I want to say it's polluted because it's gone through the gutters.
Yeah, it's got oil in it, and there'd be additional stuff in it. Yeah,
right. And it seems there's no regard for how we, you know, there's no control over building. Basically, it's just gone. And, it, you know, that's part of the reason why our economy is so screwed up in the first place. But, I mean, I'm looking at this twofold. I think we damage each other because we don't understand or study it. I've studied some soils like you have, sir. Unfortunately, I didn't get into it as far as you did, and it's really intriguing to me because I want to study more on this because I think this is a big soul problem our country is going to have. Is in the end, it's not oil, it's going to be water or the lack thereof. And you know that being out there in the Northwest. I was out there 3 weeks ago in Oregon when it was 100, or 2 weeks ago when it was 107.
Oh, yeah, people out here just melted.
Oh, yeah, nobody's got air conditioners out there.
Oh, no, yeah, they just, yeah, they're unheard of.
But I think it's intriguing. I find it interesting that there isn't an issue in some of the schools and the curriculums around here studying this sole purpose, the sole reason why we're going to be, there's not more of an outcry of lack of water.
Yeah, no, that's, I think you're right on with that in the sense that if you look down the road, and if you think like a geologist and look down the road 100, 200 years, we're going to have solved, however it plays out, we'll have solved the energy problem in the sense of whether we've decided we can do without a lot of energy or we've figured out a new cheap source of energy or we just embraced coal, whatever it works out to. The things that are really going to shape the future not only of our country but of the world are how we treat water and how we treat land, because there's only so much of both of them. And that process that you're describing of subdivision, sort of taking the soil that had essentially was a natural sponge that held rainwater and sort of metered it back out as groundwater to feed springs and rivers, that whole process has changed as we develop in the way that we have normally tended to develop for the last 100 or so years. There's moves now afoot to try and sort of rethink how we pave, to try and make porous or permeable concrete, to try and, as we build things, to make smaller changes to the way that water moves off and through the landscape, which would help to some degree with the pollution problem that you're identifying. But there's this other problem just in terms of rerouting the water, in terms of whether the water is then available for plants, how much water gets off into rivers and creeks, how fast, and changes those. And I think if you look at the issues of land and water on sort of, you know, the broad historical sweep, we're at a point now where we really can rethink the nature of how we live on the land, and we have it within our power to do it in ways that would be sustainable, that could even, you know, that are not inconsistent with development and with economic activity. But they tend to be a little different than the ways that by happenstance and practice we've established that we tend to develop.
Well, I was just going to say real quick,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think people need to study this a little bit more. But I was curious just real quick where I could go to try and get back into the soils industry, because I want to, you know, I'm a contractor and I try to be everything that I can as far as recycling and be, you know, just a handyman type thing. Mm-hmm. But I want to get into the soils thing. So thanks, guys. I'll get off.
Sure.
Great. Thanks. I appreciate the call and the interest.
The point that I was going to, and you essentially made this point, and I think it is, though, well worth underscoring. I think that here in the Midwest, we have for a long time had the luxury of not having to worry that much about water, whether we had enough.
Yeah.
Now, and certainly other parts of the country in the West, they have been worried about this for a long time, but we haven't had to. Now we're coming to the point where I think a lot of people here and in other parts of the country are saying, no, wait a minute, we really have to think carefully about how we manage this resource. So at least there's a little bit of increase in people's consciousness when it comes to water.
We're actually starting to face that in the region around Seattle, around Puget Sound, where some of the biggest concerns that come up in terms of proposed, you know, large new developments are, where will they get the water? Yeah, and this is the Northwest. I'm looking out the window. It's raining. We get a lot of water here. And yet, how much fresh water is actually available for us to use? There's not that. When you look around the planet, there's not that much of it. The oceans are pretty big, but they're not that usable in that sense.
And it just makes me think that we need to promote the idea of soil conservation, or we need to be to get people thinking about that as a resource in the way that some people at least are starting to think about water as a resource.
Yes, yes. I mean, many people have a hard enough time making the connection that, you know, water doesn't just come out of the tap. It actually came from a lake or a river or somewhere else, and it's not going where it used to go because it's coming out of the tap. But people tend to think of soils as, you know, it's the bedrock foundation for their sort of daily life. And yet it really is the most fundamental and important and undervalued resource that we have.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is David Montgomery. He's professor of Earth and Space Sciences at University of Washington, Seattle, and is author of the book Dirt, the Erosion of Civilizations, published by the University of California Press. Also an earlier book, King of Fish, the Thousand-Year Run of Salmon. And we have another caller here, someone in Urbana, so let's talk with them next. Line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I'm very fascinated and enjoying this topic this morning. I retired from farming in 2004, so soil is something that was a very big interest of mine, continues to be.
Mm-hmm.
I have several very, very quick points. One is I just returned from a family vacation in Peru and spent a week hiking through the Andes, and I was surprised at the quality of the topsoil, even up as high as 14,000 feet.
Yeah.
In contrast to the Rockies, which is my experience of tall mountains in the U.S. And they were both grazing and still raising potatoes at 14,000 feet. And it looked to me like it was a pretty sustainable form of agriculture, but it was all manual labor, you know, no mm-hmm. machines, small plots, so they could control erosion. Second point is, here in Illinois in 1980, they passed a law called T by 2000, Illinois Erosion Sediment Control Law. And the goal was to reduce soil loss to the level of the regeneration of new soil by 2000. And, you know, during my farming years, that was always a big issue, is managing our tillage practices and so on to meet our plan to reduce erosion. And I don't know. I'm trying to find a report here online to see whether we achieved the goal. By 1996, 16 years into it, 75% of Illinois cropland met the target of, was below T, which is the target, and another 8 or 10% was close to it. So I don't know whether we've made it or not, but it certainly, that was a valuable program in educating farmers on ways to reduce tillage. The moldboard plow is a thing of history here. You can't, they're not even worth scrap iron these days.
What's the dominant form that at present there?
The dominant form of tillage?
Yeah.
Or they practice. Use what they call a chisel. If there's any fall tillage done the last decade or so, I didn't do any fall tillage after corn and planted soybeans straight into the residue, the undisturbed residue of the previous year's corn crop. And then I would plant corn after soybeans and do shallow tillage. The soybean residue would be undisturbed over winter, which would hold soil in place, and then do shallow tillage with what we refer to as a field cultivator about 3 inches deep just before planting corn to prepare a seed bed.
And had you been practicing major tillage prior to that, or...?
Well, I came back to this area after being in grad school and so on, and that was during the 70s. Already the move was going away from the moldboard plow because of the erosion problem. There were estimates that I've heard, I haven't seen it documented, that the first 100 years of organic farming in Illinois using the moldboard plow and then relying on tillage for weed control resulted in loss of about half of the topsoil. It was so deep that we still had, in the areas where I was farming, Douglas County, a very rich area, we still had 12 to 15 inches of topsoil in most places. But I mean, farmers took this goal very seriously, and I suspect are close to that target of 2 by 2000 was essentially met.
That's
you now
great.
Have to have farming to participate in the federal crop programs. You have to have plans in place so that the only way you can skirt the obligation to farm and preserve the topsoil is if you completely opt out of all of the federal farm programs, which are a major source of income.
Well, one of the sort of secrets sort of out there in plain view to those who look about the whole soil erosion problem is it's one of the global environmental problems and crises that humanity faces that the United States is actually one of the world's leaders in trying to address.
Yeah, I think that we've basically been doing a good job. One of the things that caused me some cognitive dissonance, the last decade that I farmed, I converted a relatively small acreage, 30 acres, into certified organic production.
Uh-huh.
And there was no way to do that with the crops that I was growing, wheat, corn, soybeans, without lots of tillage. And I could leave residue on over winter and do the moldboard plowing, say, in the spring just before planting. But I really felt like I was beating up the soil.
Right, so you ran into the sort of organic and tillage as sort of parallel problems.
They're parallel problems, and a lot of people, I buy organic produce, but a lot of people think that that's a free lunch and that there's something pure about that, and they're not aware that the original farmers here until post-World War II were essentially organic farmers.
Mm-hmm.
And,
and the soil erosion
of
problem.
Kansas and Oklahoma was organic farming, and you know, it's huge challenges. I'm not saying they can't be met, but there are huge challenges in doing organic farming on some scale larger than a 1 or 2 acre garden plot that a lot of people aren't aware of when it comes to soil quality problems.
I think that's actually a tremendously important point that frankly, when I started writing the book, I didn't fully appreciate. And the more I got into it, you know, my background is as a geologist. So as I got into learning, you know, a bit about farming practices and farming technology and the histories of how that's interacted with erosion and soil fertility, I really had to start separating in my mind the basic erosion problem and then the basic fertility problem and sort of the possible solutions, if you will, of organic agriculture and no-till agriculture started to sort of what had been sort of a confused position in my mind as I started it, started to segregate out and, okay, these are parallel tracks. And one of the things I came to really believe as a result of doing the research for the book was that there's two really big sort of research agendas that need to be pushed in the next 100 years, one of which is trying to figure out how to do sort of large-scale, organic, non-erosive farming, as you're sort of describing with that tension. And the other is to try and figure out how to really adapt what we do to different places on a landscape and indeed different places on individual farms to the nature of the soil and how it varies on the topography. Because we tend to, I think some people, I think that some are better than others in terms of trying to tailor that.
It's a huge problem, and a lot of people are working on it and so on. One last observation. I don't want to dominate the time. I fully accept your point about the role of the plow and erosion and so on. But the other thing that a lot of people overlook is that before, say, the Midwest was tilled at all by anybody, there was huge erosion. And so the very, very rich Mississippi Delta land, which is basically topsoil that's washed down from Iowa and Illinois over the millennia, occurred naturally, no plowing. And so when you go into the river delta areas around the world, which tend to have, you know, very, very productive soils, it's topsoil that came down.
Yeah, the Nile Delta is supported by the erosion of Ethiopia.
And that predated human activity. And so there's some degree to which our erosion control efforts may be working against the natural effects of nature left alone. And I support them, but I think sometimes we don't recognize that the way these natural processes work with or without humans, and some of the areas of the world that might have been productive at one time and lost productivity, you know, whether anything could have been done to alter that or not, I think is a fascinating question, and I'd be interested in your perspective on that.
Yeah, no, that's it is fascinating. Erosion is a natural process in the sense that it happens, you know, on any kind of a slope. Even flatlands on Earth will erode by wind if given the opportunity and if bare vegetation. And everything that's eroded from one place ends up somewhere else. Deltas are built by the erosion of their uplands. And as you're saying, that the Mississippi Delta has been built by erosion over many glacial cycles, as material as Canada's topsoil was essentially scraped off by glaciers and deposited in the middle of our country, and then blew around in the wind before vegetation reestablished. There's been the landscape of the American Midwest has been very dynamic for a long time, and we can thank the Canadians for all their soil. It's been very useful, or thank the glaciers for giving it to us. But that, looking at that as soil as a system, like you're saying, that it's naturally eroded from one place, delivered to another, and how people influence that is one of those things that, to me at least, has become more and more fascinating the more I've looked at it. The most recent study I've seen of the Mississippi Basin has suggested that erosion off of fields in the Mississippi as a whole, sort of viewed as the whole basin, has increased erosion rates by a factor of about 10. But the amount of sediment that's making it out past New Orleans, out the mouth of the Mississippi, has been decreased by a factor of about 2. So we're eroding the hills and the fields more, but it's not getting out of the system. And so New Orleans has that part of their problem in Katrina, other than the fact that there was a bloody big hurricane, was that they've been settling, they've been sinking, that the land there has been deprived of the sediment that naturally would have been delivered by the Mississippi to rebuild the delta as it naturally settles and compacts over time. So how people alter those kind of systems can often come back to bite us in different parts in ways we might not appreciate.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned Egypt. That's one of the couple exceptions to your 1,000-year rule for civilizations, and that was made the longer term of Egypt was made possible by that very process. That is the erosion of Ethiopia and the annual flooding of the Nile that made it possible for that land to continue to be fertile and farmable for a long, long time.
Exactly. It's one of the reasons why some of the best farmland on the planet are on river floodplains, because that annual flood will bring sort of fresh silt, fresh soil from upstream. And the other great example, of course, is along the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, where the erosion of the Zagros Mountains and the upstream, where farming first began, fed the Mesopotamian society that was the geopolitical rival of classical Egypt. And the big early sort of floodplain-based civilizations in the Middle East are, I think, the wonderful exception that sort of illustrates the general rule of societies that once they leave floodplains and spread up to depend on agriculture on the hills outside of floodplains, that's when the clock starts ticking in terms of agricultural vulnerability.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is David Montgomery. He's professor of Earth and Space Sciences at the University of Washington, Seattle. And if you're interested in reading more of his thinking on the subject, you look for his new book. It's titled Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations, and it's published by University of California Press. We have another caller here, someone in Normal. We'll get right to them. Line 1.
Oh, great. Thank you. Good program. Mm-hmm. Hey, well, one thing I remember talking about in history class is like during the Punic Wars, I guess one of the final segments when they were the last wars, Rome, they went in there, they salted the fields around there to destroy their. I don't know. I believe my teacher told me that it's been a long time. So
yeah, it was the second century BC. Now, and Rome basically sacked Carthage. They were afraid there's an early geopolitical rivalry, and they did indeed salt the fields around Carthage to try and sort of keep them from coming back.
Was that effective in reducing the crop production there in that area?
Yeah, but, within a few hundred years, the Romans were back and farming it themselves. Okay. The thing that happened is that they brought, what we don't tend to hear about is that when the Romans sacked Carthage, they took a couple hundred thousand slaves back to central Italy and put them to work in the fields of Rome. And it changed Roman agriculture from essentially sort of small-scale family farm-like operations where they're fairly small and practiced a perennial polyculture on a small farm, and it was turned into large-scale monocultures to feed the growing capital of Rome. Within 400 years, that so exhausted the fields of central Italy that North Africa, the area around Carthage included, were the places that were growing the grains that were feeding the populace in Rome. So the Romans did salt the earth around Carthage, but they came back a few centuries later and farmed the hell out of it for a while.
Well, one thing I was wondering, because I've recently come to work for an outdoor landscaping outfit here on the side, and during the winter we do snow removal, and I never really realized it until recently, but we throw down so much salt. I didn't realize how much, like, there's this one facility where we have to de-ice their parking lot, and one time we threw down, like, 2 tons.
Whoa, in one parking lot.
And that was just one snow in one business. I mean, I don't even know. And we're just one company. I was wondering if with the advent of automobiles needing roads, if anybody has perhaps detected a shift in soil conditions. I'm sure that's been a new thing with automobiles needing to have ice free off the roads. You know?
Oh yeah, no, the amount of salt thrown on roads is amazing. I don't know what that's done to soils. I've seen some places where people have looked at sort of the chemistry of streams downstream of highways that have used a lot of salt, but I'm not aware that people have looked into that a whole lot. But it does make me think that I would refrain from buying a used car from there.
Hey, thank you.
All right, let's go on to Champaign County. Another caller here. Line number two. Hello.
The U of I is researching a corn product that would dissolve ice. So that would be another use for corn.
Would that be Pepsi or Coke?
No, that's corn syrup. I forgot exactly.
Oh, sorry. My mistake.
I haven't heard. I was off for a little bit, but I haven't heard you talk about the role of salt and agricultural societies that aren't rainfall hydraulic societies, where they actually have to pump groundwater in, and that's you can't do that forever either. And
yeah, no, that was a huge problem in Mesopotamia. The floodplain agriculture in Mesopotamia was really plagued by salt, and you can actually trace in the old Sumerian records the shifting of crops from less to more salt tolerant over time. The basic problem was that they would irrigate during the summer when there was a lot of evaporation, and they had plenty of dissolved elements in the water that was coming off the uplands there. And their water table is fairly high, so the water was evaporating within the soil column and leaving behind the salts that were within it. And if you have a really deep water table, the water can evaporate sort of deeper, it can drain to it, or you can flush it if you just keep pouring more and more water through it like they do in the Great Valley of California. But yeah, the problem of salt has been one of the big curses of floodplain agriculture in sort of arid and semi-arid areas. And it can really limit how long that the fields can be productive.
California has a solution to that by just
well, there's places
too
there's
much
a guy
water. I mean, I was thinking that, you know, if global warming goes the way we expect, then Sierra Nevadas won't be pumping the water in. I was wondering whether the salt problem would limit the growth growing in the area before the lack of water would. But
well, you know what if they don't have a surplus of water to really over irrigate, if you will, they're going to run back into the salt problem.
The other irony I thought of was when the Roman times Carthage has been rubbed out, as I used to translate it, Carthage delenda est, is that. Salt was actually the currency of the day, wasn't it? So it was a cure for their inflation problem, too, by dumping it on. I wonder who got the contract. Thanks.
Well, let's go here to another caller. Champagne.
It was probably Halliburton that got the contract.
Yeah, probably. Champagne here, line three. Hello.
Oh, hello. This has been very interesting. You've been talking a lot about the global and history of soil.
But I'm going to mention something about what I'm seeing locally, and I think it's happening all across the United States. And that's the tendency for towns and cities, and I'm from Champaign-Urbana, and to seemingly encourage going out into some of the best farmland in the world and putting concrete on it and kind of like not worrying too much about the deterioration of the infill of property that's closer to the inner part of the city, which, to my way of thinking, that should be encouraged to be built upon or retrofitted or whatever, and try not to just take all the good farmland and put it under concrete. And that's about all I've got to say.
Well, I think that is a tremendously important point. If you look out 100 years from now and worry about how we're going to feed humanity, it would be viewed as insane to be paving over some of the world's most productive farmland today. People in the future will not be thanking us for doing that, no matter how many big box stores we build on it. There really is a great concern and issue there, in part because one of the first things that's done in that kind of development is that one basically removes the topsoil because it doesn't make good foundation material. The idea of trying to preserve farmlands close to population centers is an excellent idea, especially if you think about how we're going to feed urban populations in the future. We should be thinking about how to bring agriculture into cities in terms of vegetable production, at least at some level. It's pretty hard to imagine how you get large-scale grain production in cities, but urban agriculture can be surprisingly productive. But how we could plan for synergisms between productive farmland and urban environments sort of 100 years from now, when we'll really, in the post-petroleum world, when we'll need to worry about these things a lot, is a really important issue. So I appreciate the question.
Yeah, you I think you say that, have said that, you know, we talked a little earlier about growing awareness of the issue of water. And people certainly have talked about water as a driver of conflict. You, I think, make the argument that it wouldn't be surprising to see people fighting over arable soil.
You know, unfortunately, that wouldn't surprise me to see that over the next century. I may not live long enough to see it over the next century, but my nieces and nephews may. One is likely, I suspect, to see that kind of conflict arise first in some of the areas that are undergoing aridification, some of the semi-arid areas in the Sahel, places where agriculture may be marginal already. But if we continue to degrade the farmland that we do have, and if the population continues to rise at the pace that it is and is projected to, then productive farmland is going to become one of the most valuable and irreplaceable resources on the planet.
Mm-hmm. As a way of finishing up here, we have about a minute or two. I guess I do want to finish up with the idea that there are places around the world where they are doing things that build soil. We certainly talked with an earlier caller about how here in the United States, more and more farmers have adopted either low-till or no-till kind of practices as a way of trying to cut down on erosion. So it's not something, it's something where we know how to do this. It's not a mystery, and that there are, in fact, people who are doing it.
Yes, there's farms in all 50 states in the union that are practicing intensive agriculture in ways that don't degrade the soil, but either in terms of its fertility or as a physical body, preserve it from erosion. The challenge is not really that, the problem is not really that we farm, it's how we have tended to over history. And I think one of the big challenges for this next century is trying to figure out how to align the incentives for individual farmers so that they can, in our economy and in our society, thrive as businesses while still preserving and protecting the soil for future generations.
And that is something that you do have to keep in mind. The farmers they do want to take care of the soil, but they also have to have a bottom line. They're trying to make a living and stay in business. And sometimes that can be really, really tough. And maybe it can be tough to do both of those things at the same time.
Exactly, and that's where I think that a rethinking of how our agricultural subsidies and support are set up as a society is in order. Because if there's one business on this planet that really deserves to have support from the entire population through the government, it's farming. We all depend on it.
But you also would argue that government farm policy has been counterproductive.
Oh, completely. It needs to be completely rethought. Oh, yeah. And if you think about if you adopt the naive assumption that one of the purposes of a government is to look out for the collective interests of the future, of our unborn grandchildren, to protect the ability for society itself to thrive and survive, then aligning our incentives so that farmers are able to be in business in a way that protects the soil and to thrive in doing so, it's got to be one of the big important agendas for humanity.
Yeah, that's why it makes me come back to this idea that you talk about right in the beginning, that the rocky crust of the earth may be thick, but the soil, that's the skin, that's not that thick, and it's not that hard to strip it away.
It's literally the skin of the earth, and it's thinner than our own skin is relative to our bodies.
If you would like to read more, that is, you are listening, folks who are listening would like to read more on the subject, look for the book we have talked about here. The title is Dirt, The Erosion of Civilizations. It's published by the University of California Press. The author is David Montgomery. He's professor of Earth and Space Sciences at University of Washington, Seattle. You might also want to look at his book, King of Fish, The Thousand-Year Run of Salmon. Professor Montgomery, thanks very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking.